Hello, hello everyone, and welcome to Sexography. My name is Thomas Brooks, and this is going to be episode 7 of our lockdown lecture series. I want to thank everyone for being here, whether you're a student who's forced to listen to my nonsense, a curious colleague, or just an internet lurker. I appreciate you inviting me into your earbuds today. Today's topic, we're going to be talking about cognitive behavioral therapy, particularly in terms of the grieving process. And so we're going to touch a little bit on the cognitive revolution. We're going to get into some functionalities of the therapy and then into some toxic cognition. So thank you so much. I look forward to it. So some of the key features that we're looking at with the cognitive revolution are: one, the mental world can be grounded in the physical world by concepts of information, computation, and feedback. And so we're looking at the connection between the physical world around us and the way that we're thinking about the world around us, that those two are linked. So you see a little bit of gestaltism there. They argue that the mind can't be a blank slate, like the behaviorists argued, because blank slates don't do anything. That we do come into the world with some pre-programs, that we do come into the world with some part of ourselves or part of our psychology comes with us when we're born. Not so much like the behaviorists argue that you can pretty much do or become or learn to be anything you want to be because the mental world doesn't exist and personality doesn't exist and the unconscious doesn't exist. And so all your psychology is your accumulated experiences. The cognition researchers of the time argued that, no, you actually do come into the world with some basic software, as they would say, that operates kind of in the background to help you develop who you are in a more existential, personal way. And with this pre-developed software, there are infinite ranges of behaviors that can be generated from these programs. So our memory all works very similarly, but depending on how you use your memory, that's going to determine different behavioral outcomes as well. They argue that there are universal mental mechanisms that underlie superficial variations across culture. And so this, again, goes back to the idea that all of our memory, if you're human, your memory works very similarly. But the product of that memory looks very differently depending on context. And they argued that the mind is a complex system composed of many interacting parts. So our perception, our attention, our memory, our language, our emotions, these are all processes that work in conjunction together in order to create the complex whole human. So for cognitive psychology, when this was, birthed and, became a thing, it's actually while we tend to think that cognition is primarily studied by psychologists, this isn't always the case. Generally, you can think of cognition or cognitive science as an interdisciplinary science. And so this has psychologists involved, but there's also computer scientists involved, philosophy people, linguists, and education and learning people as well. So there's a whole cluster of interdisciplinary scholars underneath the umbrella of cognitive science. So when we talk about the cognitive revolution, it's not so much that it's just psychology. A lot of fields were birthed out of this revolution too. And like I said, this area of research deals with topics like attention, language, memory, perception, problem solving, creativity, knowledge, metacognition, thinking about thinking, things like that. Anything that goes on in your noggin that produces behaviors or emotional states is something that we're interested in when it comes to cognition. And this field of study is also connected not just internally with lots of subfields, but also externally. So cognition influenced every aspect of psychology. Abnormal psychology developed because of this. Social psychology and the development of social cognition, developmental psychology, educational psychology, personality psychology, everyone benefited from this cognitive revolution in terms of the exchanging of ideas and frameworks. And one of the arguably biggest contributions that the cognitive revolution gave us was to counseling psychology. So this is going to be our cognitive behavioral therapy. CBT is a short-term behavioral treatment. So with CBT, you will be talking quite a bit about your life, about your problems, about your relationships, but the treatment in of itself is going to be very behavioral. So it's centered around the key idea that our thoughts inform our behaviors and our actions. So one of the ways that we get into this is looking at perception as a crucial in understanding how people behave. So if we can change people's perspective and change their perception of themselves and their world, then we can alter the way that they're behaving. And this very much goes back to the humanist idea that, particularly with logotherapy and Viktor Frankl, is that perception matters a lot. How you understand the world around you matters a lot. And CBT also is another umbrella term. So underneath CBT, we could be talking about relational emotive behavior therapy, cognitive therapy, dialectical behavior therapy. And in fact, most forms of therapy nowadays, whether you're a old school psychoanalysis person, or if you're really into behaviorism, or if you go to a humanist or logotherapy session, all of these are going to be influenced and have elements of CBT in them. So it's not like CBT is also just off in the corner by itself either. It also has influenced every other aspect of therapy too. So this is very much a educational process, which is a little bit different than our humanists or gestaltists who were kind of like, free love, man, love yourself, self-actualize. The CBT person is going to get right to business and go, what kind of work do we need to be doing here? Some methods that are used, journaling, challenging beliefs, mindfulness, thinking exercises, reflective exercises. These sorts of things are very common in CBT, and it typically lasts about 16 weeks or less. So you're not going to be in therapy very long. Typically, you're going to go in for a single problem. You'll go for an hour or half an hour a week, and you're just going to check in, and the therapist is going to give you homework. Y'all are going to reflect on the homework of the past week, do some conversations about the context and the relational information that's necessary. But this is very much an in-and-out process, and health insurers love that. They do not love psychoanalysis, because as Ben said, psychoanalysis could take you years or decades to go through without any clear outcomes or goals. So with CBT, we're looking at a short period of time, so it's not a financial risk for people who need to make money off of your mental health. And there's going to be solid goals in place in order to justify giving you that money to, you know, improve your mental health, depending on the circumstances and the situations. So what are some of the ways that we can apply CBT in terms of grief therapy? So this comes from the British CBT and Counseling Service. If you're in my death and dying class, you will notice that I use lots of British sources, UK sources, and that's because they're a little bit more on the game with thanatology and death and dying than Americans are. So some of the things that the British CBT and Counseling Service recommends, so put aside a period of time each day to think about the person you have lost, so compartmentalization. So rather than letting yourself, you know, swim through emotions throughout the day, set some time aside every day and use that time to work through your grief and work on your grief and think about that person and reminisce. They also suggest to fill your day with routines and tasks which trigger a sense of achievement and pleasure. So making sure that you maintain stability in your schedule and that you're constantly rewarding yourself for doing things, that's important. People's reactions and comments tell you about them and their thinking and feelings, not about you. So if you have those snotty family members or friends who don't really get grieving and they're kind of insensitive, then their insensitive thoughts and feelings and behaviors and, you know, comments, that says more about them rather than about you. And so making sure that you compartmentalize and individualize those experiences so you don't internalize them. They look argue for looking for support in the right places, so making sure you have the tools to weed out the trash from the treasure in your social groups when it comes to who you should be disclosing to and who it's safe to, or going to therapy. And they also argue not to rush or judge yourself. So grief is a period of change, and that's something that we need to have patience with ourselves, and we need to let the process play out, and we need to be active through that process, but we don't need to put timestamps or expectations on ourselves. So that is the approach to grief that most CBT just generally focuses in on. Earlier I said that there were some toxic cognitions that needed to be worked out. And some of these are a little bit rough because they're very hard to work out of your system. And if you are able to stop some of these cognitions in one context, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to stop them in another. So this can be something like self-references. So this would be when you say, people always focus on me, especially when I fail. So this is the idea that everybody's watching you and that they're judging you, and you need to be hypervigilant and how you present yourself in public and around other people because everybody's thinking nasty thoughts about you. You can do selective abstraction, so only my failures matter and they define me, rather than, you know, being generous with yourself like you are with other people in your life that you care about, and say that failures are a learning process and that they don't define me, like they don't define my friends and family and students, etc. Overgeneralizing can be a problem. So if something is true in one setting, it's true in every setting. So I've been betrayed in romantic relationships, so now every single social relationship that I have is at risk for betrayal. That can be something that needs to be broken down. We need to break down excessive responsibility. So taking responsibility for yourself and your actions is important. But if you're taking responsibility for every single failure and every single bad thing that happens to you and everyone in your life and everything on the planet, that's a little excessive, and we need to tone that back because you're only causing yourself to grieve. We need to break down dichotomous thinking. So if we're thinking in terms of good and evil, black and white, good and bad, healthy and gross, that these sorts of dichotomies also lead to some problems, because the world doesn't quite work in dichotomies. That's kind of a human imposed system. And so one of the things that we need to break down is these dichotomies into more of spectrums or large categories of variance. So making sure that we're not just having two different perspectives on the world is important. And we can also look at something called masochistic epistemology. So this is the idea of whatever hurts is true. And so this is where you see people who self-abuse online, where they go and they, like, you know, post selfies of themselves in discussion boards that are designed for everybody to pile on and talk trash about you. This can be where you're doing behaviors that hurt in the real world, because when something hurts, then that means it must be true and that's some sort of stability. And so breaking apart this masochistic epistemology can be really helpful, especially if we're looking at self-harm cases. One of the things that, or one of the toxic cognitions that we need to, that tends to come up quite a bit within grief counseling, is the idea of fortune telling. So this is the belief that you can see into the future and have a prediction of how things will exactly play out. So this could be saying something like, I'll never be happy again, there's no more good in life, I'm going to be grieving forever, you can't recover from grief, closure is a joke. And so the counselor or therapist or whatever will counter this thinking with questions like, well, how can you be sure you'll never be happy again? Have you ever had an emotional state that lasted forever? And so you have to be challenged, you have to have a therapist who's willing to challenge you on some of these basic assumptions that you make that aren't really serving you. And so the goal is to help people finally accept stuff like death and grieving and have the courage to say goodbye and start to move forward in their life. They can't, you know, you're never going to get the closure that you want, and grieving is never going to go away, but there is a spectrum of functionality, and mental well-being that needs to be achieved as well. And that's something that people who are grieving are going to have to figure out and work for themselves. And so CBT operates to challenge those thought processes that undermine the goal of feeling better or being better or feeling well, or, you know, becoming functional again. And so that's really the value of cognitive behavioral therapy, in my opinion, is that it challenges people in the right kind of way. So it's a great way to, you know, check yourself and get read by a therapist for thinking things that aren't necessarily helpful to you, that aren't necessarily true, or that are causing you more harm than good. So that's something to definitely pay attention to and appreciate about CBT. This has been a very, well, I've been on this for almost 40 minutes now, and have barely scratched the surface of the cognitive revolution. Obviously, you can take a college class on cognition and spend the entire semester, or two semesters, three semesters. I think I've taken like 8 cognition courses at this point, and every single one of them is a little bit different, and they focus in on different aspects of cognition. And so this is very, very basic, and there is much more to be said on this topic, but I'm going to leave it right there because we're at 40 minutes already. Have a beautiful week. It's been a pleasure being in your earbuds, and I will talk to you again later. Bye.